evening, welcome. My name's Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic. We'd like to welcome everybody here for our fifth anniversary meeting of the Primary Purpose Group. We've been meeting here since on Monday night, since 2007. In this room every Monday, we'd like you to come back. We have a book study, and we're privileged and honored to be able to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Typically, on our anniversary, we invite a speaker that we think will carry the message the way we do on Mondays. And we had a speaker plan. We've had the speaker plan for quite some time. And his name is Dr. Burns Brady. He's an especially good speaker because he can speak on both sides of it. He's been an active drunk for many years and then been sober for 35 and actually been a doctor in the treatment of addiction for just about the same amount of time. Well, unfortunately, you know, I heard Friday that he was undergoing surgery today. So if we could, just let's take a moment of silence for Dr. Burns Brady, recovering up in Louisville, Kentucky. Thank you. I called him just before he went in today, and he is spiritual really good. And he said, I said, there's a lot of people here in Atlanta that were really looking forward to your talk, and he promised that he would come back next year for our sixth anniversary. And he said, well, Jerry, he said, I'm 75, so I may die between now and then. And if I do, just get my body, prop it up next to the podium, and put one of my CDs or one of my talks in. So, on Friday, we had like all hell broke loose because we had to get all the home group members. We started emailing, texting, and talking about who we could possibly get that would deliver our message in such a short period of time that wouldn't mind, you know, following, you know, Burns Brady. You know, it's kind of like if you're in broadcasting and, you know, you're going to follow Larry Munson from the Georgia Bulldogs, you don't want to be that guy. And we can only think of one person that has such little ego that would be willing to do that. And, you know, all the emails came in, and, you know, like, we're voting, and we're waiting, and all this kind of stuff, and there's lots of reasons for lots of people, but tonight's speaker, Christian Proctor, is the one that came through. And I thought I'd share some of the reasons that we picked Christian to speak this evening. It's kind of like a top 10 thing. All right, number 10. These are the top 10 reasons that our Primary Purpose Group asked Christian Proctor to speak at our fifth anniversary meeting. Number 10, Ridgeview needed more room in Cottage C for incoming patients and had to put Christian somewhere. Number 9, his sponsor Bob gave us $100 touch money and said, let the kid speak somewhere. Number 8, Ridgeview was the only facility that actually Christian hadn't yet attended. Number 7, speaking here tonight would keep Christian from 13 stepping the girls at 8111 or the Triangle Club. I forgot you were coming. All right, number 6, neither Charlie Sheen nor Lindsay Lohan were available to come tonight. Number 5, he threatened us with actually performing the emergency surgery on Burns Brady if he wasn't allowed to speak. All right, number 4, he was already an accomplished pitchman from his drinking and using days. Number 3, it was revealed that Christian was actually the love child of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. Number 2, it would help him in his personal quest to overtake Dr. Drew and Walter Hagen. And the biggest reason was this. He took a solemn oath that if we gave him this opportunity to speak, he would quit drinking forever. And we say that in kidding around, but I met Christian when I had probably 30 days sober. I met him in a meeting, and from behind me, I hear this guy talking, and this guy is maniacal. I'm thinking, if he's not drinking and using, then I must be crazy. This guy was wired. And I came to realize that wasn't the case at all. He was just very excited about being sober, and he's been that way ever since. Christian is a very, very active guy. He's been, every time I've asked him to speak, and it's been a fair amount, he's always said yes. He's been active in the lives of this group. I mean, when we thought about starting this group back in 2007. I said, how about joining? I think you have a place here. And he said, it's not really my timeline right now. But he offered up another name. And that guy came to this group and brought a bunch of his sponsees. And that was really the formation of the Primary Purpose Group back in 2007. Also, he works at a book study that he's been at for years over the We're Not a Glum Lot that a lot of people in this room have attended. He's a guy that knows what he's doing. He's a guy that carries the message. And we are so honored and pleased that he said yes tonight. With that, I'll give you Christian Proctor.
I told Jerry, paybacks are a bitch. Years ago, I sat right out there. My name is Christian Proctor. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 7, 2001. And I know some of you are thinking, he cleans up pretty good. Some of you are thinking, what the hell is that square doing up there in a suit? The reason I wear a suit when I stand behind the podium is because I represent something. I represent the power and magic in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an example. I don't represent AA. I don't speak for AA. What I'm here to do tonight, more than anything else, is to hopefully disturb you on the question of what alcoholism is. I identify as an alcoholic, but I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. The best way I've ever heard alcoholism described is it's a manifestation of the way I think and the way I feel. And I will do anything to change that. I abused, used, ran around, cavorted, was homeless. I did anything and everything I could to destroy my life. And I didn't think I was destroying it. I thought I was partying. I remember calling my mom from a homeless shelter, the Salvation Army Red Shield down off Marietta Street. Great place. So it's like the Ritz compared to Peachtree and Pine. It is. It really is. You get a bed there. It's really nice. But I remember calling my mom from there once. And I was like, you know, hey, Mom. And she says, you know, Christian, your problem is you just party too much. Now, at this point in time, I had been homeless for about 16 months. Now, I'm not talking homeless like couch surfing, you know, sleeping in a car. What car? I mean, I was legitimate homeless. And every time I have a guy that I sponsor who thinks that he can't ever get there, I take him back over off Marietta Street, over by the train tracks, and I take him around the back end of one of these old utility buildings, and I point to the dumpster that I slept behind. And when it's really cold, if you're lucky, you can get some cardboard and maybe a can of Sterno or a couple of candles. You could get some old used tinfoil and wrap it up over you because it would retain just enough heat in there so you didn't freeze to death. Because, see, the homeless shelter wouldn't take me because I had been drinking. And it's important for me to realize I'm a survivor, but alcohol was taking away all of my options. So let me give you just a little background. I'm the oldest of three. My dad worked for a major company that is headquartered here in Atlanta, and we eventually made it here when I was 13 years old. Now, at 13 years old, I was not the striking man you see in front of you. 13 years of age, I was 4'9", had a little squeaky voice, and I was afraid of everything. I was the class clown. I tried to be funny. I tried to be hip. I tried to be slick. The one thing I wasn't was bad. I didn't have a single cool bone in my body. But if I could get you laughing, you might think I was funny. And if you thought I was funny, then you might think I was cool enough. But none of the cool kids wanted to hang out with me, and I so desperately wanted to hang out with them. Now, I can't tell you today what a cool person looks like, but I can tell you what I thought cool was. What I thought cool was somebody who put others down, who was kind of a bully, who had the girls hanging on their arms, you know, everything that I wasn't. And you got to picture it, freshman year in high school, right? I went to a large high school over in East Cobb County, Lassiter, and before Hope High School was built, Lassiter had a 4,000-plus students in it, and they had a split schedule. And the upperclassmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors would show up at 7:30, and the underclassmen and freshmen would show up at 9:30. Now, I shared a locker with an upperclassman. He was a sophomore. He was a giant. He was like 5'10", you know? And I'm sitting there, and I'm feeling this experience of being so humbled by this big guy. And he was a jock, man. It was like, and girls would talk to him. They acknowledged him. They would look at him. They would say hi. I would just kind of go, hi. How do you do that, man? But, of course, I was too scared to talk. Well, a couple other upperclassmen came over, and they were talking to him one day. This guy's name was Scott. Scott and I shared a locker. So I'm up there trying to get to my locker. You know, it's on the top shelf, go figure. I thought that was a cruel joke all through freshman year, man. That pissed me off. But these guys say, and they looked right at me. I swear they looked right at me. And they said, you coming to the party on Friday? Now, it was the Friday after Thanksgiving. This was Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. And I looked right at him, and before I could say, yeah, he said, yeah, I'll be there. I'm like, God, I wonder what goes on at those parties, man. Because, see, I had seen Porky. I knew what kind of stuff went on, shenanigans that occurred with cool kids, right? I knew there was going to be loose women there was going to be tons of drinking, there was going to be partying, probably some wild animals running around. It was going to be a party. Well, somehow this guy felt sorry enough for me. I don't know what it was. It was probably the long that he asked me if I wanted to go. And guess what? It was just like Porky, but different. We got there, and the first thing I noticed when I walked through the door was this huge metal container. I found out later it's called a keg. And there were guys like doing these things, pumping it and getting beer out of it. And then there's another guys over in the corner, and they had these, and I think it was Busch beer, but it could be Coors, I'm not sure. All I know is there's a tall boy, they were taking a pen, they were popping in the bottom of the beer, and they were pulling it up, and in one fluid motion, called shotgunning, you would open it, and it would all run down into your stomach. That looked pretty easy. So I did it the first time. About 90% of it went down the front of my shirt onto this white carpet. Now, that was their first mistake, having a party with white carpet.
Yeah.
You can see they were also drinking things like Cisco, you know, that fortified stuff, right? You know, the screw cap wine, that was everywhere. They were smoking this non-habit forming marijuana out of these long glass tubes, you know, when bong water went everywhere. But I didn't give up on that first beer. I wasn't going to, and I was embarrassed. But they looked like I wanted to feel. You know how that looks, right? They looked like they were confident. They were comfortable. They looked like they knew they got it. They got the joke. They got the whole inside line. I heard a speaker say once that before I was born, God handed out these instruction manuals on how to deal with life. And like I was outside catching a smoke. I missed it. It's like everybody else seemed to know what was going on but me. And I wanted so desperately to be a part of it. And so I didn't give up. I took that second beer, and as I pulled it up, I bit into the bottom of that damn can. I was not going to let it get out over me, because I wasn't going to be made a fool of again. You know? I was hanging by a thread, and as that beer hit the bottom of my stomach, everything got real warm. And I don't say warm like hot warm. Like warm like this. Like this glow, and all of a sudden I looked around me and everybody started getting shorter, because see, I was getting taller. My shoulders started to spread out. My voice started to oh, everything on me got bigger. Everything. And I found myself feeling really confident, feeling very funny. I heard a speaker say it once, and I can completely relate. The guys wanted to be me, and the women all wanted to be with me. Now, that sensation that I've just described lasted for about half an hour. And then I was introduced to the joys of bong smoking, and apparently you do not cough into it. But everybody's got their first time. By the way, all you all laughing out there, you've done it. You've done it. I was introduced to the joys of drinking Cisco. Apparently, I enjoyed it a lot because I decorated the carpet and the wall with it. And I woke up the next morning around a toilet. That was going to be common for me. Waking up next to a toilet was common. And I had puke all over me and most of the bathroom. And it was awesome. It was awesome. That night was awesome. Because, see, everything clicked for the very first time in my life. it clicked. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to be that guy. Now, I don't know if I became an alcoholic after my first drink. I have no idea. I have no idea. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous acknowledges patterns of drinking. And at some point in time, we cross over this line. In Bill Wilson's story, he talks about alcohol ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. He wasn't drinking for fun at some point. He was drinking because he had to. Now, I can tell you that I went from being a straight-A student to B's and then C's and then D's. I smoked my first real joint within 6 months of my first drunk. I took my first trip, the one he doesn't never leave the room on, within 6 months of taking that. I also had my first suicide attempt. Because, see, I couldn't get what I wanted as often as I needed it. And see, I was still dealing with these insecurities, fears, guilt, shame, remorse, not being good enough, not being tall enough, not being smart enough, not being enough, not being enough. But see, when I drank and I used the way I did, everything fit, my skin fit. You know what this feels like? And I'm going to steal a line from Burns Brady. Mood. Mood. What problem? So what? The girls are laughing. I'm cool. I got it. And I wasn't cool, but that's how I felt. Alcohol and drugs changed the way I perceived reality. Now, here's the weird thing. I really thought that everybody drank and used like I did. I really did. I really thought that was true. Now, the people I was drinking and using with, they did. But they would stop at, like, time to go home time. You know what time to go home time is, right? You know, you're already in trouble, but you're not, like, going to be grounded yet. You still have use of the vehicle. I didn't do that. My grades slipped. I dropped out of high school my senior year because it seemed like the right thing to do. I was smart enough. I was confident. But I had a new best friend. And then, you know, my parents and I, we agreed on something. Oh, by the way, I was a pretty decent kid growing up. My parents and I got along pretty well. I was the first, so I broke them in, right? My brother and sister had it much easier than I did. But I broke them in. You know, they didn't know how to deal with the problem child. You know, they tough love. You know, they try to go to the church. They try to have the guy come over and scare me straight. You know, there's all kinds of good stuff going on. I got high with the guy who tried to scare me straight, by the way. Not scare me straight like heterosexual, scare me straight like scared straight. You know, like, because he was an ex-con. And he was supposed to, like, get my attention somehow. Yeah, right. And it didn't scare me. Because, see, I don't know about if any of you can relate to being young and bulletproof. You know? It was like, what consequences? Sure, I caught a little bit of this. Sure, I caught a little bit of that. But I never really had any consequences. So my parents and I decided at age 17 that I should leave. It was the first thing we agreed upon. From the time of my first drink until then, we had argued all the time. We'd find all kinds of nonsense reasons to argue. I would create arguments. I would, just to stir it up, you know, because it's a little too quiet around here. Let's start some, you know, I'd start something with my sister or brother, and they decided at 17 I should leave. And so I did. And I moved in with four guys, me and three other guys that moved over in Chamblee. We had a 900-square-foot apartment that was $410 a month. You can do the math. That's $102.50 a month. I had difficulty coming up with $102.50 a month. Now, I blew through well over $1,500 to $2,000 worth of drugs and alcohol, but I couldn't come up with $102. I had to end up pawning my title of my car for $100 to pay rent. That car eventually got repoed because I couldn't even come up with the $150 to get it back. And see, it's like, and I got booted out of the apartment. You know, and then somebody said, hey man, what are you doing this spring? I was like, I don't know. They're like, Dead's coming. So we went on tour with the Dead. I had nowhere else to really live. It seemed like a pretty good idea. To this day, I got a real problem with the smell of patchouli. But we did all the excesses, man. Went all over the place, man. Had a great time. Spring tour, what's not to like? No consequences. Every time I'm getting into a place where I'm about to catch a, you know, getting a jackpot, I always got an out. Somebody's willing to put me up. Somebody's willing to let me go on tour. Somebody's willing to give me a second chance. Well, little by little, I didn't realize I was burning all the second chances as I went along. People got tired of the lies. People got tired of the nonsense. there was so much drama having me around. And I got to the place where I was almost buying friends. I don't know if any of you can relate. You'd show up at somebody's house with a bag full of stuff or a case full of beer. Hey, man, what are you doing? Well, I'm hanging with you now. Come on, you know? And that's how I would get a place to live for the weekend, you know? And I did what they call geographic tours. I would try to go to different places. I moved to, I moved to Columbia, South Carolina. I lived there for about 6 hours, and that sucked. Then we moved to Myrtle Beach and lived in Myrtle Beach for a while. I moved to Wilmington, North Carolina for a little while. And I moved to Clemson, South Carolina for a little while. And then I lived all up and down from Midtown Atlanta all the way down to Alpharetta. All kinds of different places. You know who kept showing up everywhere I went? Me. That's a bitch, man. When you show up everywhere you are and you're the one screwing yourself, that's a bad place to be. Now, I worked in restaurants for a number of years. Great job for alcoholics, by the way. But my last restaurant job before I got sober, I'm going to share this story with you because it's really appropriate for where we're at. I was homeless for 19 months. I was over in a place called The Bluff doing something really stupid. And instead of getting shot, the guy hit me over the back of the head with a 38, nickel-plated 38. I remember it. It was a flash of glint, the light that hit me. I was just, he should have shot me for what I had done. And I did like all heroes do. I went back to mom. I was 25 years old. And I was beaten. I weighed 105 pounds. I had a lot of teeth kicked in. I had lost a lot of, I had stuff living on me. You know, being homeless is not pretty, it's not glamorous, and I don't share that. Oh, by the way, me being homeless doesn't make me a worse alcoholic. It just makes me a dumber alcoholic. Because, see, I had all the road signs along the way telling me that this is a bad idea. All the reasons in the world to get off the street. Every one of them I ignored to pursue another drink and another drug. Now, I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I qualify as an alcoholic because I have alcoholism, but I used a lot of additives. I use a lot of cocaine, a lot of crack cocaine. I use basically whatever you got. You got pills, okay. You got powders, cool. You got something in a needle, okay. I used it all. And when I came in March 26, 1998, I was at my parents' house, and I was recuperating from my last run, you know, like all heroes do, and I was stealing stuff from my parents and pawning it, whatever I could get, because I was unemployable. You know, I couldn't even stand to look myself in the mirror. I couldn't tell you the last time I had shaved or bathed. And I decided, this is it, I'm out. My dad's going to be coming back. He was literally on the other side of the planet. He was over in the United Arab Emirates, which is in Dubai. You know, Dubai is, literally over there near Kuwait. You know, anyway. So he's coming back home, and he ain't going to tolerate my nonsense. I can get over on mom for a little while, but dad ain't going to have it. And so I took him on a look at my mom's pill stash. Now, my mom had lost a kidney. My mom is a really weird addict, by the way. All right, I'm going to tell you this just so you can understand what I'm dealing with here. My mom had a kidney removed, and she was on pain medication. Before she left the hospital, they weaned her off of it. You know, the good stuff. You know, Dilaudid, Demerol, Darvocet, Percocet. You know, she was being weaned off of all those pills. And guess what happened? She never needed another one. She was physically addicted to those drugs. But she didn't need them anymore. There's still, at one point in time, there was still a bottle. It was over 20 years old when my mom finally threw it out. There were still 4 pills in the bottom of the bottle. I know it's the saddest story you've ever heard, you know. But I mean, there's like a half inch of dust on top of this thing, man. She didn't need it. She didn't want it. She doesn't understand me. So I'm looking at my mom's pill stash. She's got all these pills. She has this blood thinner, so I take the whole bottle of blood thinner, it's called Coumadin, and I pour it into this little dish. 50 pills. And she's got another pill, because I'm thinking, I'm just going to take them all, bleed internally, and die. That's the goal, right? Here's the game plan, check. Die is the goal, right? So I got pills I'm going to take that are going to take me out. And then I got a little freaked out over it, you know, because it's death, you know, it's a little hairy, you know, you don't come back from that one. And so I got a little stressed out, so I took my mom's whole thing of Zoloft. And I poured that whole thing in there, you know? And I thought, this might hurt, so I took all the Darvocet and I poured that in there. And I got this dish full of like 100-something pills in there, you know? And I'm not taking this to get high. I'm taking this to die. I'm tired. I'm sick and tired. I'm out. I'm out. I am taking the easy way out. I don't want to fight no more. And then I looked at the dish and there just wasn't quite enough in there. So I took the other bottle that was on the shelf, and it's called Lasix. Had I done my homework, I would have known that Lasix is a diuretic. It makes you pee a lot. So as I'm taking big old handfuls of pills and washing it down with malt liquor, I keep having to get up to piss. Now, when you're trying to die, that's a sad place to be, man. You know? But I eventually got enough of that out of my system. I started to feel the effects of the medication. And again, I'm washing it down with malt liquor, a Magnum malt liquor, big 32 ounces, man. And I'm washing it down. And I got my dad's old Walkman, and Walkman is this tape thing, and the tape thing is, for those younger who don't know, it's a type of recorded media. It predates CDs. And Prince's Purple Rain is what I've decided to go out. Right in the middle of the guitar solo. I'm going out. I'm out. Now, I kept having to get up to piss, kind of interfering with my whole suicide thing. You know, it's really pissing me off. But I eventually fell asleep. And I remember one of the last lucid, conscious thoughts I ever had prior to that moment was, thank God it's finally over. Now, I did not plan on waking up the next morning. But when I did, I had blood coming out of my eyes, my nose, my ears, my penis, my ass. I was dying. I was bleeding. And I couldn't stop it. And I freaked out. And I called my mom. And she came and picked me up and took me over to Kennestone Hospital, and they immediately put me into 4-point restraint, handcuffed me to a gurney. They yanked my pants down, they put a catheter in my penis, and they started shoving liquid charcoal down my throat. Now, anybody who's been there, good time, right? Good time. Humbling. It's cold in the emergency room, fellas. And so anyways, I'm wondering how I look to the nurse who's walking around, thinking, as soon as I get out of here, maybe I got something to offer. What I've just described to you is picture perfect clarity of what alcoholism is. I am dying. They've got the little things on my chest, and they're watching EKG readouts because, see, I'm going in and out. They're not sure if I'm going to walk out of that emergency room or not. And I'm worried about how I look. I'm worried about what the nurse thinks. I'm dying, and I can't see the gravity. So I end up over here. How did Steve? They didn't let me do anything by myself. They wouldn't give me anything sharp, like a pencil. They wouldn't let me have a lighter. I could go smoke out on the little deck. And it sucked. And when I left here, I went to the Salvation Army. Now, I was introduced to the book of Alcoholics Anonymous here. I was given a copy of it. Now, the suggestion to read it, they may have said it, but I didn't hear it. Now, back in 1998, I don't know what life was like in AA around Metro Atlanta. I can only tell the AA I experienced. Living at the Salvation Army, which is a homeless shelter, you do what they tell you to do, or they'll put you out. And they didn't have a problem doing it. They're a great organization. They help a lot of people. But as I'm sitting there in the meeting, you kind of have to picture the meeting. Picture a circle of people, you know, the old timers. They're like 90 days. And they got all those new guys in the middle, you know, with like 10 days. And they're telling us these great things. It's the first drink that got you drunk. Just don't pick up and use no matter what. Keep coming back. Meeting makers make it. Really? I hadn't read the book, so I didn't know that what they were telling me was not tried and true. There wasn't a good track record with what they were sharing. And it's funny because the old timers didn't seem to stick around that long. They kept seeming to go out. A lot of people I heard sharing things like just go to meetings, don't rush into taking the steps. They kept relapsing. They kept coming back, and they had to be in the middle with those new guys again. You know? And I thought you just kind of got sober for like 90 days at a time. And so that's what I thought because that's what I experienced. And this is really important. If somebody had talked to me about working the steps or getting a sponsor, I didn't hear it because it wasn't what was prevalent. It's not what was being shared as the primary message of that meeting. Now, I only went to the meetings I had to go to. I didn't go to any meetings other than that. I saw nobody really seeming to embrace and experience and enjoy this thing called recovery. And so I was a meeting maker for 18 months. I was dry as a popcorn fart, man. You didn't want to smoke around me. I was dry, man. I was irritable. Now, I didn't realize that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they described me. Restless, irritable, discontented. Because I don't know what drinking and drugs do for you, but they calm me down. You know? The book and the doctor's opinion talks about, to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. See, I thought everybody got a little bit taller and a little bit smarter and a little bit more cooler when they start drinking. I just thought that's what happened. I asked my mom after I got sober in 2001. I asked her, I said, what happens to you when you drink? She goes, I feel goofy. And I'm like, nope. I feel very confident. She goes, I feel a little lightheaded. I was like, nope. I feel very clear. I know what I'm going to be doing next, you know? And it's like I couldn't hook up with what normal drinkers feel, because normal drinkers don't feel like I did. So I was working in a restaurant for a little while. Now, again, I've relapsed at this point, 18 months. I never went back to anything else other than an occasional joint, but drinking. I drank every day if I could. And there would be some days that I would swear I'm not going to drink again. Because, see, again, I'm a toilet guy. I wake up around toilets, right? Now, I didn't lose the house. I didn't lose the job. I didn't lose the car. My worst physical bottom was my first time. Now I'm back out there, and I drank for another year, and all I did was drink. And you know what? It was for a little bit. Little bit. I remember I went to go work for this one restaurant downtown at a golf club, and I was working as a sous chef there. And the first day I worked there, it was cool. The chef pulled me aside. He goes, all right, I keep a bottle of Gentleman Jack in the bottom right-hand corner of my desk if you need it. I needed it the first day. Because it gets hairy in the kitchen sometimes. He says, I'd rather you have a little shot of Jack and get back to work. Well, you know, I must like three of those bottles. You know, plus I drank and I drank and I drank. And here's my drinking in a snapshot. I would wake up at 6:30 or 7 in the morning. I would get a couple of beers, and I'd go to work in the morning at 9 o'clock over at this other country club in Roswell. And I would open that restaurant up, and then I would leave there at 2 o'clock, and I would drink on the way downtown over at Ansley Golf Club. And I would drink on the job for the next 3 or 4 hours. We'd work the rush, and then I'd get off at 9:30, 10 o'clock. I didn't have to close anything down because I was a sous chef, and I would drink on the way. Now, I would leave Ansley Golf Club. It's right there at the corner of Monroe and Piedmont. There's a Kroger right there. Now, I would go from that Kroger to the Highlands, 4 miles. And in 4 miles, I would kill a six-pack or the bulk of a 12-pack going over to my buddy Spooner's because, see, we're going to go out and drink. I know what you're thinking. I've already been drinking. No, 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 no. I had to drink to get ready to go drinking. And we would drink up until 2:30, 4, 5, maybe 7 o'clock in the morning. And I would get up and I would go do it again. Sometimes 1 hour sleep, sometimes 2 hours sleep, sometimes no sleep. And I was a very functional alcoholic. And I kept wanting to die a little bit more than I wanted to live. And I finally hit a bottom. August 6, 2001, I won what I had been shooting for, which was the coveted Employee of the Month award. That's how sad my life had become. If I could just get that Employee of the Month award, man. I'm going to show you how cool I am. You know who goes for the Employee of the Month award, right? Not the cool kids, man. Hey, the cool kids going for that one. But I got it. I'm standing there holding that $250 check, and I got that little plaque in my hand. And I'm feeling this experience of like, oh, man, I peaked. This is it. It's all downhill from here, man. Nobody's clapping because they want to. They're clapping because the manager made them come to the damn ceremony. I had beer on my breath when I picked up these things. And that night, I went home and I drank. And I drank all the next day because I called in sick. Because I was just, something in me told me I'm not going to make it out of this alive. And I looked over on the shelf and there was this book. One of the very few things that I had maintained. The book. Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It made this really funny noise. This is not that book. I have it at home. But it made this really weird noise when you open it. It goes, which told me I had not read it. I hadn't even opened it. I'd set many a beer on it. But I looked at the first promise of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know why, but I believed it. It's a story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. I had a friend back in high school who had recovered from cancer. Not remission. It was absolutely gone. His prognosis was very favorable. And you know how much his life changed when he got that prognosis? All of a sudden, college became an option. All of a sudden, getting married became an option. Being a father became an option. Becoming a grandfather was all those things that suddenly were not available while he was going through the treatment were suddenly very real and possible. And he had talked about the word recovered. He has recovered from cancer. I picked up on that you could recover from a disease that inhabits my body, that you can actually live life. Because see, I don't know about you, I didn't live, I was existing. Anybody? Anybody just get out of bed because you had to, not because you wanted to? You know? So I went back to the Salvation Army, and I paid attention this time. I had a big book, and this cat named Leonard showed up, and he's a member of the Heavy Hitters Group. The Heavy Hitters Group is an AA group out of Decatur. And he did this weird thing that nobody I'd ever seen do before. He looked at us while he was talking. And he talked about things like the hopeless nature of alcoholism, that it is chronic and progressive. I didn't know he was coming out of the book. Hadn't gotten that far in yet. He talked about this disease does not discriminate. It don't care who my daddy is. It don't care what education I have or lack thereof, how much money I got, where I was born, who my relatives are. It doesn't care anything. My pedigree, my title, my lineage, it don't care. Black, white, gay, straight, male, female, it don't care. The democratic evening up process of alcoholism, it don't care. It'll rob your ass of life just the same. But there's a line in here, and I love it because it just, for me, it gets people's attention. It says, when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. Now, I tried human aid. I tried the doctors here. I tried shrinks. I tried medications. I tried my dad's minister. I tried even a priest my mom knew through her church. I tried all kinds of things. I tried girlfriends, mini girlfriends. I tried new friends. I tried old friends. I tried everything. I tried mom. None of it worked. No, I could get a little piece of time, but I couldn't seem to stay sober. And you know why? Because it sucked being sober. You ever felt, you take alcohol out of the alcoholic, what are you left with? Ick. Why would you want to feel like that on purpose? You know? I love how my friend Kip Collins says it. He goes, I'm not an alcoholic. I got an acute allergic reaction to sobriety. You know? Because everything's so real, and people expect things from you. Responsibility's a monster, man. I've never been accountable to anybody. And I'm failing at everything I try. It's like everything I touch turns to crap. And so I was listening to Leonard. Leonard started talking about these things called hope, integrity. Remember that one? Remember when he traded in integrity? You remember when he traded in trust for another drink and a drug? Remember when he traded in any kind of hope? Remember when mom started looking at you with that look like dad just shook his head and your friends and family just, they didn't know what to do with you. They were at their wit's end because, see, they're watching us die. And they're powerless to do anything about it. And what's even more sinister is we were powerless to do anything about it. We just didn't know it. And so when Leonard was talking to me about this thing called alcoholism, I knew I had to go to the meeting he went to because at the Salvation Army meeting I was going to, it wasn't being shared. Now, it doesn't mean it wasn't there. I just didn't hear it. And I went to the heavy hitters. And I can tell you this, it only took me a couple minutes to figure out I was the only white guy there. I was the only white guy there. And I didn't realize I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with some prejudices. Now, I don't know where I picked them up. I got some probably pretty well-intentioned uncles somewhere who shared with me their philosophy of life, and I probably picked it up and made it my own. But as I'm sitting there and I'm feeling this overwhelming need to leave, like I had a vehicle to go anywhere. I mean, where am I going to go? I'm over near East Lake Country Club, man, up in Glenwood. My ride isn't leaving. I see these two hands, and it's like the guy behind me could tell I'm like ready to go. And these two hands come up over my eyes, and all of a sudden I hear this, and I cease to be in a room full of black men. I was in a room full of alcoholics. They were talking about the hopelessness of alcoholism, the baffling features, the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great my necessity or my wish. I couldn't stop screwing myself. I meant to stop. I wanted to stop. I had every reason in the world to stop, but I couldn't stop. And they understood. And then they talked about things that I couldn't even wrap my head around. Getting a checking account. I don't know about your experience. I was 18 when I lost checking privileges. Because if there's a check in the book, there's money in the account. At this point in time, it took them 3 to 4 to 5, maybe even longer days to figure out there's no money in there. They revoked my checking privileges. But they talked about getting that back, getting credits restored. And then they hit me with some other ones that I didn't even know I needed to hear. Because, see, I heard all the promises. You don't ever have to drink like that again. All right, cool. You don't ever have to feel that way again. Cool. Don, my first sponsor, hit me with this promise. He says, Christian, you don't ever have to be alone again. And that may sound like a really simple, trivial promise. But when it hit me, I realized for the very first time how alone I had been for so long. That there was not one person on the planet who wanted to hear from me. My parents were like, would lock down the house if they knew I was in Cobb County. I'm serious. They revoked any kind of visit privileges for a while. I didn't have any friends. I had buddies. I had some acquaintances, coworkers, but nobody I could call and really talk to. But these guys in this room, they understood. And so I screwed up and I asked Don to be my sponsor. Big mistake. I can tell you honestly, I picked Don to be my sponsor because of the car he drove up in. It was a 300Z with a 3-piece BDS knockoff wheels, man. He had a really nice system. It wasn't his car. It was a loaner. I think he drove like a Celica or a Corolla or something. And Don got me into the big book. Now, I spend a lot of time talking about that first experience because in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about this thing called alcoholism. Alcoholism has so very little to do with alcohol. Alcoholism is a manifestation of the way I think and the way I feel. It's a disease that manifests my mind and my body. I will be driven to the point of insanity until I take a drink. Unless, like, I love how the first step says it. It says, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. If you look at it, it does not say I can't drink. It doesn't say that. It says I'm gonna. No matter how much I don't want to, if it's just me, I'm going to drink. You see, that's my experience for 16 years of drinking. I'm going to drink. No matter how great the reasoning, the logic, it'll eventually give way for some random nonsense, BS reason to pick up another drink. I'll get away from you just enough. I'll stop calling my sponsor just enough. I'll get away from service work just enough. And then something will happen. I'll get chapped lips or a hangnail, you know. Or some girl won't acknowledge my presence. Or my boss will ask to talk to me and talk to me about my bad attitude. What's his problem, you know? It's like, and I'll find a stupid reason to drink. Now, I won't think all the way through. Because, see, I don't remember homeless. I remember Mardi Gras. I don't remember homelessness. I can when I shared my story with you, but in those moments I don't go back to homeless. I go back to Mardi Gras when it was fun. You remember fun, right? Remember when it became work? Work ain't fun. That's the reason they call it work, you know? And then it became a lot of work, and then my drinking and drugging became pain. It's like there's a wise prophet, Axl Rose. And I love the way he says it in his song, Mr. Brownstone. I used to do a little, and then a little didn't do it, and a little got more and more. The price I paid out there to get a little bit of relief was horrific. I couldn't even get even anymore. It's like I could just dull the pain a little, but even that stopped working. And there's a part in the big book where it suggests, on page 25, it says, if you were seriously alcoholic as we were, read the story. Listen to people in the meeting. Are you as seriously alcoholic as these people were? The authors believe that there is no middle-of-the-road solution. Middle of the road. Middle of the road. Did anybody ever try to drink? No, you drank. Anybody ever try to get a little high? No, man, you got loaded. That's what I did. I don't know about y'all, man. Anybody come in happy and well-adjusted? All right, cool, my people, all right. But there's no middle-of-the-road solution. The book says then, if I have passed into the... I was in a position where life was becoming impossible. For me, it was only the breathing and being awake part. I'm good when I'm asleep. I'm good when I'm passed out. But it's dealing with things like work, responsibility, paying taxes, obeying the speed limits, you know, living amongst you. I just had a difficult time with that. Life was becoming impossible. And the book suggests, we believe, if I have passed into the region from which there is no return through any kind of human aid, I have but two alternatives. And I love how the big book says it. One of my alternatives is to go on to the bitter end. And then it uses these words. It says, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. Blotting out the consciousness. As long as I'm not aware of how bad it is, it ain't that bad. The problem is, it stops working. We have alcoholics and drug addicts have what they call a moment of clarity. And a moment of clarity is different for everybody. My experience is, all of a sudden I saw exactly how bad it was. I saw exactly how much pain I was causing. I saw exactly how shitty my life was. And it was unacceptable to me. And I looked at the big book, and I thought about killing myself again. And I realized I had not done what's in this big book. And so when I came back to the Salvation Army, and I heard Leonard's story, and I went to the heavy hitters, and I hooked up with Don, and Don gave me my first service commitment. Now, service sounds like grunt work, doesn't it? Service. We want you to be a service. I thought it was grunt work. You know what my first service position was? Tuesday night triangle meeting, make coffee and greet people. Now, of course, what I heard is make all the coffee, greet all the people. Anybody ever tried to do it a little? Little is good, but more is better, right? I'm chasing people down in the big meeting room. I'm sweating bullets, man. It's like October. I'm like 2.5-3 months sober, man. I got the turbo pot, the regular pot. I got the decaf. I got the cups. I got the blue stuff. I got the yellow stuff. I got the stirrers, man. And people are leaving messes. And I'm over there cleaning stuff up, man. You know, because see, I know if I don't do it right, you're going to fire me, and I can't get fired because I just got this job, man. And they'd look at me, they'd be chasing them down. You know, like, hey, come here. You know, and they'd like, you know, you're new, aren't you? And I'd be like, how does he know? You know, because I'm the freak over at the coffee pot, man, you know? That's how we know. And I would hear stuff. I would hear stuff in meetings, like, keep coming back. There's some spiritual power in those words. You know what keep coming back means? Persevere. And when it gets bad, you keep coming back. Because, see, life ain't fair, man. Life don't care that I got sober. But I keep coming back because, see, I found a solution in these meetings. I found a solution in this program. I found a conscious contact with the God of my understanding through this program. So I made a third step decision. I thought it was a little hokey that we have held hands and prayed. But we did. You know what third step really is? That I decided I'm going to quit playing God. The big book says it doesn't work. You know why it doesn't work? Based upon just my work history as playing the part of God, you would have fired me a long time ago based on performance, man. My job, I suck playing God. Because, see, I always think that you know that you should do it my way. And if you just saw it my way, you would agree my way is much better than your way. My way sucks. You know who's in it? You know who wins in my way? Me. You know, either I'm going to get what I want or you're going to get what I want. I like it when I win, you know? Saw a movie once. This character, Steve Buscemi, the actor, walking up to somebody, he says, okay, heads, I go home with you, and tails, you go home with me. And the woman says, what kind of deal is that? He goes, it's a great deal for me, man. And I can completely relate to that. Because, see, I was always, what's in it for me? What am I going to get out of it? You know, I love the way Keith Lewis used to say it. You know, it's like, you know, when we get up to heaven, man, it's like get to the pearly gates. We're like, hey, man, here's a little tour. And as you walk down one hall, he says, hey, come in here. all these file cabinets have all the questions you've ever asked. I guarantee you 90% of the questions I've ever asked is, hey, what about me? What's in it for me? What you got for me? Hey, what are you going to do for me? Hey, don't do that to me. I was the center of my own world, man. And yet I was my worst enemy. That's a bad spot to be in. So in the third step, I made a decision that I was going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. That's a problem for a guy like me, because I got a Roman Catholic mom and a Southern Baptist dad. You can do the math real quick. Friction in that household. The word God brought up a lot of frustration. And I was screwed in either camp. I didn't go through catechism, so I'm not good on that end. And the other one is, if you thought it, you might as well have done it. I'm screwed, man. And Don listened to what I talked to him about when it came to God. He listened. He didn't just automatically make up his mind that it's going to be this way. He listened. He actually did what the book suggested. In the chapter Working with Others, it says, talk to the man and find out all you can about him and his religious leanings. I have some really screwed up religious leanings. He then suggested what seemed like a novel idea. Christian, why don't you come up with your own conception of God? And I remember thinking, but you can't do that. And he goes, why not? And if you really get down to it, the chapter We Agnostics, it's really asking the question, why not? Why not? Or am I so positive about something that it's not possible? It's not possible that a guy like me could possibly have a relationship with a power greater than himself? So he said, here's what I want you to do. And I took this piece of paper and he says, I want you to write out a job description, a one ad. Anybody ever go into classifieds? Look for a job that way? You know what that says, right? For a guy like me in restaurants, I would look for line cook, sous chef, prep cook. Wanted. Well, I did the same thing. Wanted one higher power. And he suggested three things, and everything else was up to me. And the three things he suggested out of the gate were the words omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence. All-knowing, all-powerful, all-places. You see, a guy like me had a teeny tiny little God and a great big disease. He suggested I have a power greater than myself that's greater than my disease. That's got enough power to kick my disease's ass. So that's what I did. And he says, cool, you wrote it? Pray to it. And I gave him some cool stuff, too, like must love NCAA sports because I think they try harder. You know, you get the NFL contract, you can relax a little bit. But these, you know, college guys are trying to get the contract, so they're really, I felt, you know, and I put stuff like that down. I actually tried to wrap my head around God. Anybody ever tried to do that one? Take enough acid that you're like, whoa! You know, you come back screaming, yes, my man. I love that. He sticks his head out a little bit and goes, right over here, dude. But then the third step was really nothing more than a formal declaration. I'm going to be living into this thing, and I started doing an inventory. And I didn't want to do an inventory until I realized it was about my favorite subject, me. And I was looking at things that I had never stopped to consider but had always dominated my life, like how angry I was, how resentful I was, how afraid I was, how much guilt, shame, and remorse I had experienced in my life. Nobody raised their hand when I asked if we all came in happy and well-adjusted, so I'm going to assume that all of you can relate to those feelings. Being lonely in a room full of people. Anybody? Yeah. Being afraid to look people in the eye when you're talking to them. Because they're going to look right into you. And they're going to see that you don't know what you're talking about, or that you're scared, or that you don't feel like you belong. I can relate to that. So I did this inventory, and I shared it with a sponsor. We did a fifth step. Now, I don't know what your experience is, if any of those who have done a fifth step, and I encourage it. Highly encourage this step because it's very cathartic. There's a healing that happens when you share that stuff you're going to take to your grave. And I sat with my sponsor at the time, Art Sutherland, and we were over at the Atlanta Men's Workshop. We sat on two little stumps and we invited God to sit on a log. I don't know if God sat on the log, but this hawk came and landed on a branch. And for the next almost 6 hours, that hawk stayed there. Every now and then it'd be like, number 43, and blah, 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 and he'd go, still there, right? You know, I figured he's blown off on that one, you know. And then there was two or three on my inventory that I wasn't going to share. I just wasn't going to share it. No, no. And my sponsor sensed that I was holding something back. And then he shared a couple of the things that he was so ashamed of the first time he did it this step. And you know what he did? He made it okay to be wrong. He made it okay to be fallible. He made it okay to make stupid mistakes and own them. Not drink them away. Not try to imagine that they never occurred. So we did this fifth step, and I can tell you with all honesty, there's two promises in the big book that meant more to me that day than ever. One is we can look the world in the eye. I was a shoe guy. I could have told you what your shoes look like more than your eyes, because I would do the real quick up and down. You know how y'all some are. Some of you are getting a little offended that I'm even like trying to look you in the eyes as I'm speaking to you. You know, I'm not a PO. I'm not trying to perp on you. You know. But the other one is we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Now, being alone is a state. Being lonely is a feeling. I haven't been lonely since I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, unless I chose to isolate. When I'm around you, I'm not lonely. I can be alone and not lonely. I didn't know you could do that. And we did this stuff. We took 6 and 7, and we asked God to come in and remove my greater handicap. And then I made a list of those people I had harmed, and I started on my 9-step amends, and I started living into the 10th step. Now, I can share this because it's important. New in sobriety, I didn't really know how to get out of that hamster wheel. Anybody had a thing called a burning desire? Back as a kid, we used to take this thing called a magnifying glass, and we would hold it just right with the sun, and you could cook bugs, man. Just watch them pop on the pavement, man. You know? I don't do that anymore. But, you know, we would do this stuff. You know what a burning desire is? When I'm completely focused on one little issue, it becomes the biggest thing. I'd make a mountain out of a molehill, or as my friend Dwayne Stark used to say, I'd pole vault over rat turds. You know? I'm just getting all bent out of shape over nothing. And I learned this experience from my sponsor, okay? I had my whole ass fell off somewhere around 9 o'clock in the morning one day. Now, I called Don at 10. Did I talk to him about it at 10? No. I sat on it. And then I went and I called him at like 4 or so in the afternoon, thinking I should share it with him, and I didn't. I saw him in the parking lot of the 8111 Club over in Sandy Springs. I walked right up to him, and I didn't share it then. I saw him getting coffee inside, and I didn't share it then. Somebody says, is there anybody who has something they need to share or a burning desire? Boom, my hand went right up. You know what Don did? He got my attention real quick. Took me outside. And he did this thing that forever, and I share it with any of the guys I work with. He goes, boom, I shoot you in the foot. How long are you going to wait to go take care of that? And I'm thinking, I'm going to Grady right now. Bullet wound, Grady's your place, man. Trauma is aboard, man. He says, right, so you have been injured, and now you're going to wait all day long. And then you're going to take a meeting hostage to dump your crap. You had 4 opportunities, 3 just in the last 10 minutes. Talk with me. Why didn't you? And what he taught me is what the 10th step says. I continue. See, these first 9 steps clean the slate. 10 keeps me in the game. I learn in 10, 11, and 12 how to be a sober, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And more than just staying sober, because see, there's a difference between being sober and enjoying sobriety. Those who are enjoying sobriety have a big smile on their face because they take this program really serious. It's like they get it. They get the joke. They feel comfortable in their own skin. They're not pretending to be somebody they're not. Did you know you could do that? You know, you can actually be you on purpose. I know, it blew my mind the first time I heard it. Some of you are going, whoa, you know. I heard a woman named Tina D say once, she goes, AA has taught me who I am, and I get to be that person on purpose today. And to be a to live a life of purpose. 10 is so important, man. 10 helps me, because anybody like relief now? Like to-go food, like drive-through, anybody like that? Did you want to call the guy who had what you needed and then wait a week? Mm-hmm. Now I'm gonna share something with you, because see, this I learned this one the hard way. Anybody relate to standing in line at the liquor store with a case of beer under one arm and a handle of Jack or something in one hand? Nobody? Yes. All right. It's audience participation. I appreciate it. Can I ask you a question? Did you feel better when you were standing in line? Didn't even have a drop in our system. We already feel better. Anybody feel better pulling into the parking lot of a meeting when your ass is falling off? You haven't even heard it yet. You already know that you're going where the good stuff is. I used to love sitting on my couch and I'd be waiting. You know that wait. Oh, God. Finally, the phone call comes and I hear the cryptic message. Grab my keys. I got my phone. I'm out the door, man. Because you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to score. I feel better just going to get it. Christmas Day or Christmas Eve? For me, Christmas Eve is always so much more pleasurable than Christmas Day. You see, it's the anticipation of something. You know? And that's what AA offers us in this step if you choose and embrace and you're willing to persevere. Is there's this gift. Remember Axel, the wise one? He would say that I used to do a little and a little didn't do it and a little got more and more. The pain I paid out there became more and more and more, and the relief I got was less and less and less. It's different in here. Because see, the more and more and more I do, the more and more and more I enjoy it. And the more and more and more I enjoy it, I don't know about you, but I like doing things that feel good. You know? And I get a little excited about this thing. Somebody once said to you, they said, you know, Christian AA is in the pep rally. And I said, yes, it is. Because, see, my book tells me that if newcomers could find nothing of joy, of excitement, of what's going on in these rooms, they wouldn't want to come back. Why would you want to come somewhere where everybody's sitting around going, got my 51. Wife kicked me out. But I didn't drink. Yay. I'm a cheerleader for AA. And I'm not the only cheerleader for AA. There's a lot of people coming here, and I can spot one right here. She's one of the biggest ones I know, Lindsay. She gets so excited at watching somebody's life come up. And I'm picking on Lindsay because there's tons in here, man. They love watching this program take root in somebody's life. Because, see, we know what's on the other side. We know what lies before you if you continue. And I'm not trying to plead to anybody in this room to embrace and work this program. I'm simply suggesting that I am a happy customer. I am a satisfied customer. And the cool thing is it's free. The only condition is that once I have discovered what it is, I have to be willing to give it back. But the cool part is, man, you remember when you had that really good weed? You know the really good stuff, man. You can't even open the bag, it stinks so bad, you know? You always wanted to turn somebody on to it, man. They'd be like, nah, man, you ain't got nothing like this. No, wow, man, you gotta try this stuff, man. It's legit, man. It's a one hit, man. And you know what? And then they'd be like convinced, and they'd be like, you know what, you're right, man. It is one hit, man. You know? This is the one hit, man. This is the ooey. This is the icky sticky. I worked at this one bar. They sold this liqueur, and I'm not sure if I'm Louis Tron. It was like $85 a shot.
What?
Yeah. Louis Tron. Crystal decanter bottle, Baccarat Crystal. It was a celebration stuff. It was only special occasions. We get to open something like that in these rooms all the time, man. We don't wait for a special occasion to break out the good china. We're living in it all the time, man. Every day in AA is infinitely better than every day I had out there. Now, don't get me wrong. I had a lot of fun until it wasn't fun. And then I had a lot of pain until the pain was so unbearable I wanted to die. Steps 11 and 12 are so important to me. Steps 11 is I sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand it. I pray only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. You know what's really cool when you stop trying to run the whole universe? Back in the day, they used to have this show called The Ed Sullivan Show. And they had this guy on there, and the only reason I remember this, my parents made me watch the 50 years of TV special of Lucille Ball and something else. Lucille Ball was a comedian back in the day. A lot of people like Tom. But they had this guy on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I got to demonstrate it to you because it's really funny. He would come out, and there would be these big boards with all these little sticks on it. And then this crazy music would start. And he goes, dun 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 dun. Yes, I'm asking that. And he'd start spinning plates on these pegs. And he'd have like 12 of them going all at the same time. You know how crazy that looks? That's what excited people back in the 50s, you know? There was no fires, there was no explosions, there was no nudity, it was just like, and I'm glued to the TV, man. I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, oh, because you know what's going to happen, right? It's gonna start. They're going to start to wobble, yeah? And as they does, he's all over there spinning these plates. That's how I lived my life until I was 28 years old, constantly trying to spin plates and looking around and they're all breaking. I'm eventually left with one plate, and I couldn't even keep that one going. I'm going to share one more visual for you because it was really important for me. I went to this huge church, not affiliated with any particular church. I found God more often in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever had in the church. I've got nothing against any kind of form of organized religion. You want to see somebody, you want to see God? Watch somebody pick up a 30-day chip. That's God, man. And I watched this guy, he was a real heavy-set preacher, he was a guest minister, and he got up there and he had that little microphone, you know, like the rock stars, you know. And he's sitting there, and everybody noticed there was this huge balance beam, you know, the gymnastics-style balance beam, but it was about 2 feet off the ground. And as he got on this balance beam, it was fun. I mean, everybody in that church laughed. You know, it's like that, you know, big guy, little jacket. You know, and as he's doing this thing, he's on the balance beam, and he's like, whoa! You know, he's barely moving, but he's all over the place trying to stay balanced. Early in AA, that's what we look like. We're all over the place, man. Meeting. Call my sponsor 50 times a day, man. I'm not going to the... All right, I'll go to the dance. You know, it's like, we're nuts. Picking up cigarette butts because we've got to, man, because we're crazy. That's what we look like early in sobriety, man. None of us look good. But we're staying sober. And little by little, we become like the gymnast who later came out, and she did a backflip pirouette and she landed. Now, what's funny is she looked like she was standing still. She wasn't. They were doing the exact same thing. She was better at it. You know why? Because she practiced it. She practiced it. Like, we practice these principles in all our affairs. You know how you get honest? By practicing being honest. Did you know you could tell somebody the truth and your head won't explode? I know, shocking. Blows my mind. Did you know you can be that person that somebody else has that experience with for the first time? You think working the steps is great? When you start practicing what step 12 does? Having had a spiritual awakening, I am more awakened to 10 and a half years of sobriety than I was to 30 days of sobriety. I'm more awakened. I see things different. I can see God in things that I would have missed years ago. There's this movie that came out years ago. It's Kevin Costner. It's called Field of Dreams. His family saw the ghosts. Is that plural? Ghosts? Yeah. Saw the ghosts playing baseball on this field that he had created in the middle of an Iowa cornfield. They're all playing baseball. All the greats from the 20s. He's watching them, having a great time. His brother-in-law doesn't see it until the very end. And his feeling is, where did all these baseball players come from? Things have been going on all around us all the time. When you start to see it, you'll grab somebody's leg and go, did you just hear that? Did you see that? I watched the guy we knew was going to die. We knew he was going to die. And he picked up his first-tier chip. You know what he said? He had his hand out. It wasn't shaking. It took 6 months for his hand to stop shaking because he was that bad when he got here. He's still sober. You know what he does? He has a sponsor. He goes to meetings. He practices these steps as often as he can in all areas of his life. He sponsors other men. He lives a happy, joyous, and free existence. My first year of sobriety, I did one thing right, other than not drink. I didn't date. I met a woman on day 367. I was engaged within 2 months of that first date. Shows you the kind of activity that goes on in my head. And, of course, the relationship didn't last. Didn't drink. Learned a lot from it. I learned how I could place my dependence upon another person ahead of a dependence upon God. And it's real easy to do. I got actively involved in teaching the Big Book. I do teach the Big Book. I try to make it enthusiastic and I try to make it enjoyable. Enthusiasm, by the way, next to the common cold, is the most catchy thing that you can be around. It's very communicable. Because a candle loses nothing by lighting another candle. And enthusiasm, you may not necessarily want what I have, but you might be interested in what the hell I got. You know? Why is he so excited about this thing? Because, see, I'm not paid to be here. I'm not Burns Brady. And some people came to hear him. And some people may have left when they found out it was me. But I'm grateful for the ones that stuck around. Because, see, I don't know who's going to hear what I have to share, and I don't know what you're going to hear. I can only tell you what's coming out of my mouth. What you hear is God's business. It has nothing to do with me. You know? I was doing the Big Book study. There's two guys that used to be really important members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say really important not because they're better, but what they did is they took this Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and they broke it down. They started getting into the history. They started going into the reasoning why they use these words. You know, this book is written in English. A lot of us don't speak English anymore. We use the slang verbiage that is so... We have to look words up, you know? And they broke it down. It's called Joe and Charlie, The Big Book Comes Alive. And they started doing this back in the 70s. And what Joe and Charlie did is they made this book, written in the 30s, accessible to me. Because, see, I got nothing in common with an old proctologist and a has-been stock speculator. An ass doctor and a stockbroker. Got nothing in common with guys from the 30s. Until they broke it down, and I realized if I pay attention to the date, if I pay attention to the name, if I pay attention to the city, I'll miss it. If I pay attention to how they felt, how they thought, how they acted, the consequences as a result of their drunkenness, and their attempts to do it themselves, I'm in this book. And I know a lot of you are in this book. And I started sharing and teaching this book and sharing enthusiasm about this book. And matter of fact, I hugged Lucille before the meeting. Lucille's son, Jeff, showed up over at the Mar Men's Center, and I love this story because it's such a big deal. He came in and he was a full-blown methamphetamine addict. Full-blown, man. Meth. You know the whole, you know, the twitching and everything lasted for a while, man. And I say that kind of jokingly because we used to watch him. And you know what he did the whole time he was in that meeting? Mad dogging us, man. I ain't like you guys, man. I'm a meth addict. And as we started talking a little bit more and more and more, because see, the Big Book only talks about alcohol in one step. It's the first step. All the other steps have to deal with the way I think, the way I feel, and the way I act. Me running the show on my own terms and how crazy that is. How much pain there is. Oh, and that maybe a power greater than myself that I choose to call God can enable me to live a happy and joyous existence. But little by little, Jeff was listening to these meetings, and his arms started to drop a little bit, you know? And then he wasn't crossing his arms once. And then like 6 weeks after he started coming there, he opened his book. It was like a huge day for us, man. Jeff opened his book. Cool. You know? And he came up to me after the Big Book study was over, and it took us almost 6 months to go through it. And he says, when I came in here, I was a methamphetamine addict, but I caught alcoholism from you. It enters through the ear. And you can catch alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And you can catch it and survive through the program of recovery and the 12 steps in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or you can ignore it and die. Because I don't know what your experience is. If I was to walk up to this podium and I was just, I got a real bad cough, and it hurts, man. And I went to the doctor over at Wendy Hill. And he said, is that a hospital store over there? I don't even know if it's over there anymore. I went over to Kennestone Hospital, right? And they put me in an x-ray machine. And he takes me back and he shows me this slide. He says, see that little gray dot on your lungs? That's what's causing your hacking cough. I can see it. I can see it. Whatever it is, whatever the pain is, I can see it. Alcoholism doesn't show up like that. Now, some people will sit there and tell me that alcoholism shows up in their rap sheet. Drunken disorderly, public intoxication, DUI, or maybe in their life, divorce, lost my career. You know, normal people lose their jobs. Normal people get DUIs. Normal people do all this stuff. None of that makes you an alcoholic, because I never got a DUI. Never lost a career. I threw a lot away. They're still there. I didn't lose them. They're still there. I didn't get a divorce because I couldn't keep anybody around long enough to marry me. That's not how it shows up. It's a manifestation of the way I think and the way I feel. You can get a really killer diagnosis in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And once you get it, we encourage you to share it. The more you share it with other people and help them to discover their alcoholism, the less your alcoholism affects you. That's been my experience in 10.5 years. Now, back to the Big Book study, and I'm going to wrap it up with this because this, for me, was one of the most pivotal moments. I knew that God had a plan for me. I didn't know what it was. I was at the tail end of a 3-year relationship, and it was a relationship I should have gotten out of after a year, but I'm a glutton for punishment, so I stuck around for 2 more. Anybody? Yeah, all right. We need to talk, all right. And I got out of the relationship, and my sponsor at the time was going in for prostate cancer surgery. You know, this all happened within, like, 3 months. I pulled the trigger, not literally, I pulled the trigger on ending the relationship. I moved out. I didn't know where I was going to move to. My sponsor's laying in a hospital bed after having his prostate removed. He's laying there. He's all doped up on the pain medication they've given him. And I walk in the room, and he looks right at me, and as solid as he could be, sober as a judge, he says, "Well, what are we going to do now?" His wife and his wife's sponsee were sitting right next to her. His wife's a member of Al-Anon, and one of her fellow Al-Anon members is sitting right there. And she goes, I got a condo. Now, I was out of the blue visiting him. Out of the blue, they two just happened to be sitting there. And out of the blue, just came up. I didn't make that happen. The job that I currently have right now, at about a year sober, I went for a temp agency job. You know what a temp agency is, right? Temporary. Not permanent. And I apparently hadn't killed the brain cells that know how to type. You know, I hadn't killed those. I killed the brain cells that know how to, like, talk. But I hadn't killed the brain cells that know how to type. And I started a job the next day making the same amount of money I was killing myself doing in landscaping. They hired me on a year later. Anytime I want a gratitude check, I go on the company I work for's website and I look at the criteria, the job requirements to have the job that I currently have, and I don't meet a single one of them. I don't have a college education. I don't have any of the requirements. Math was my worst subject in high school. You know, I was too busy getting high. And I just had those. I've been working for that same company for 8.5 years, making more money legally than I've ever made in my life. There's a lot to be discerned in that statement, by the way. And I kept doing these things. I got a vehicle in my own name. It took me 6 years of doing it their way to finally get to a place where I could rebuild my credit and actually get a vehicle in my name. I got a place where my wife and I now live, and my wife's probably the coolest part of the story. I was over at a treatment program over in Sumter, South Carolina, taking a Big Book study in there, doing a 3-day weekend. And this beautiful blonde walks up to me, and I think she's coming to talk to me. No. She's asking a question about the Big Book. She's walking up, smiling at her book, and she goes, "Can you tell me about this part right now?" I thought she was, like, smiling at me. But something told me I needed to talk to her. So we went out to dinner with a bunch of us the next night, and we had dinner together. A whole bunch of us asked her to go smoke with me. And while we're out there smoking, there's something tells me I'm supposed to keep talking to this woman. Now, she lives in Sumter. I live in Sandy Springs, Georgia. And we're having this, we start a dialogue the next day. And we started talking to each other every single day for a minimum of 3 hours every day. Most of the time was 4, 5, 6, sometimes even longer hours, staying up till 2, 3, and 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, what the hell could you possibly talk to somebody about for that long, every single day, for weeks? Unless maybe there's some God in it. We would finish each other's sentences. We would laugh and cut up. We would share stories. And her story was real close to my story in a lot of ways that were important, and in other ways not so much. Similar music taste, similar literature taste, similar things, similar goals, similar conception of God. God picked my wife. We didn't start our relationship over anything familiar to me, like just lust. Because I had had many relationships that were only lust, no substance. Now, I was attracted to my wife, but we learned about each other and fell in love with each other before we ever touched each other. We finally met up. I met her father, and he gave me his blessing. And last December 4th, 2010, she stood still in front of God and everybody and said that she would marry me. I love my wife. She's my sweet pea. She's my angel. She is the greatest gift I've received from God, and I wouldn't have it if it weren't for AA. I wouldn't have it. She's a tireless trooper for this program. She's an amazing sponsor. And she keeps me so grounded. She's so much wiser than I am. And she honors me so much just by being in my life and allowing me to be in her. Now, I'm not saying you come into AA and you get sober, you're going to have a relationship like mine. There's a lot of people in sobriety that don't have a relationship like mine. I got an amazing relationship, not only with my wife, but with a host of friends that I never thought I would have, want, or even need. Want, have, or even need. When I got here, the only thing I wanted was the pain to stop. You know what I want tonight? I want to eat after this meeting. I want to really, literally swim. And I've taken up a lot of y'all's time, and I so appreciate the opportunity. Because it is an opportunity and a privilege to stand in front of you and to shout from the rafters how great Alcoholics Anonymous is. And I'll leave you with one final thought and give the book the final thought. Because I think that's one of the gifts that we have, is that there's so much more going on than just what we see. Get a tea out of vision for you. I just love what this book has to give. It says, it may seem incredible that these alcoholics are to become happy, respected, and useful once more. How can these alcoholics rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you. Should you wish them above all else and be willing to make use of our experience, we are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. Thank you.